Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. This show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people who we have the great fortune of learning from on a regular basis. On today's show, we welcome Tanya Wenman Steele, who is the CEO of Cooking Up Big Dreams and serves as our own award director for the Julia Child Award. In this episode, we'll learn what it's like to bring a group of kids to dinner at the White House with Michelle Obama. We'll go behind the scenes of the Julia Child Award. And in our last segment, we'll hear Tanya's Julia moment. So stay tuned to find out what exactly is a Julia moment. On each episode of Inside Julia's Kitchen, we're going to launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. Julia was passionate that being able to cook was vital to living a healthy and fulfilled life. Many of you may be familiar with hearing Julia say, "Everything in moderation, even moderation." She was quoting Oscar Wilde, but also firmly believed that life wasn't about restricting yourself from certain things, but that balance was really the key. Julia also understood that it was critical to learn these things at as young an age as possible, especially since she herself was a late bloomer. That's why I'm excited to talk to Tanya about her quest to help kids learn to cook, next on Inside Julia's Kitchen. Welcome to the podcast, Tanya.
Thanks so much, Todd. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have you here and to get talking to you about all the many interesting things you do. So before we get into the kid stuff, I want to ask you about your past life, not your past lives, but just one of your past professional lives. So I know you would probably never say this, but I will say it for you. You were instrumental in the development of Condé Nast's successful recipe-centric website, Epicurious, which certainly in the early days of the internet was one of the go-to sites for recipes. So I wanted to ask you, what were those halcyon days like, and what do you think now today represents the cutting edge of food websites?
Oh, well, thanks, Todd. I feel just so lucky to have been kind of there towards the beginning of the digital landscape, not just in food, but in the world at large. I came to Epicurious, I think, in 2005, and at that point it had been a lovely home to Gourmet, Bon Appetit, and The Traveler, Condé Nast Traveler, basically reposting their content from the magazines and building a recipe database. So it was so exciting to be given the opportunity to take a little team and a little bit of money and start to grow it. And I'll remember there were so many, now looking back, so many fun things that began that, you know, while you're in the middle of them, you don't really know what they are. So, for instance, I was in a meeting once and somebody came in and said, "Well, we've just talked to Apple and they're developing something called a smartphone and they want us to make something called an app." And we were all like, "What's an app? How do we develop something? We don't even know what it is." So just being kind of on the forefront of that was just very exciting, and creating what ended up being one of the most popular food apps in the world was really a big thrill. So I just feel really lucky to have been there at that time.
What do you think it was that made Epicurious, because there was so much going on and people were still learning, do you think it was the connection that you were sort of coming out of the following of those leading food magazines?
Yes, it was, you know, a very interesting time, because when I first got there, most people were just literally copying and pasting the content that were in magazines at that time. So the notion of creating whole content just for the web to speak and think and feel correct and suitable for the web was a new concept. So it was a great moment because we could be as creative as we wanted to. We had to figure out how to communicate via the web, realizing that it was more visual, that we needed, you know, shorter introduction, shorter words, that in fact SEO really had to play a big role in everything that we did, which is search engine optimization, for those of you who don't know, and that videos mm-hmm. really play well to the form. So all of those things were learnings that we had that are very evident today. I mean, that's kind of how every website and content producer builds their content.
Do you also sort of credit that smartphone emergence and that opportunity as one of the impetuses to get people to think more about original content for the web rather than cutting, pasting from print?
I think definitely the phone has changed the way we consume media and content and the way we think about it. So absolutely, yes. You know, now I think 60 or 70% of web traffic is from phones, and I think that'll only go up as people just become more and more used to looking at small screens rather than larger screens. In fact, you know, our kids, Todd, will always prefer to read things on their phones instead of a piece of paper or even a larger screen. It just seems normal to them. So
yes, anything that's handheld, as long as it can be handheld. It might not be a phone, but as long as it's handheld and not sitting
right,
on the desk.
Exactly.
So do you think, should I reframe my question? Do you think the cutting edge of food websites is actually not a website, but some kind of app or platform on a phone? Is it Snapchat Food?
I think that the cutting edge will, and I think forever on now, remain social media for content and food content specifically. Because at the end of the day, there's been a paradigm shift as to who you trust and respect, and it is no longer top-down content from publishers and experts. It's now from your friends. So that social media is the way to get that. It's the way to interact with each other, to show your own, you know, great cooking skills, and to, you know, to show them off. So I think that is and will remain for a long time to come, the way that people really interact with food content.
So if you're out there and you're thinking, or you work for some sort of media company that is looking at a food web kind of platform, you think that's a key way to think about it, is how it's going to be presented and used via social media in a sort of peer-to-peer way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that everyone in my field now thinks mobile first, social second. And things like destination websites are kind of fading into, you know, their internet startup days glory. You know, it's especially with the way that Facebook is now about to change their algorithms to showcase content that is really just you know, friend first rather than publisher, so that in your feeds you'll see things that your friends have posted much more than you'll see anything that, you know, the New York Times or the Journal or whomever you're reading will be posting. So that will, I think, even solidify even further this notion that, you know, it's all about you and your friends rather than what other authorities and experts are telling you, which, you know, there's good things about that and there's bad things about that.
Yeah, maybe we'll save that for another discussion. But I think that the net I'm getting from that is the cutting edge in food websites today is that it's not a website.
That's exactly true. Yes.
Okay. I got that out of my system. So now let's talk about kids and cooking. and a subject that I know you're really passionate about. So my first question is really, where does your passion for that subject, given that Epicurus was not kid-centric, where does that come from?
You know, I actually trace it all back to Julia Child. My family is from England, and my mother, God love her, she makes fabulous tea and coffee, but really not that much else. I mean, she's really, you know, she can do some toast, but when we came to this country when I was a kid, I realized pretty quickly on that this was not going to be, that food was good, but I wasn't getting good food. So I watched PBS, and they were showing reruns of The French Chef. And so Julia Child really inspired me to, you know, as an eight-year-old, to start to cook. And that inspiration has led me to get other kids of that same age range to get into the kitchen and be creative and be confident and, you know, kind of taste and travel the world through the kitchen and feel good about themselves. And as a secondary attribute, to eat healthfully, because the more you cook for yourself, the more you can control what you eat, and you can eat as healthfully as possible if you so choose.
Yeah, no, I think that was something Julia really advocated. You can't really lead a healthy life. It's very difficult to lead a healthy lifestyle if you don't know how to cook and you never cook for yourself.
Exactly. Even if you do use the amount of butter that Julia loved, which I do sometimes.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, cooking competition shows have also, I think, hopefully showed people who watch them, when a chef is trying to make a dish to, you know, impress the judges, they use an amount of butter or oil on a piece, you know, on a steak that generally I certainly wouldn't use at home, and maybe Julia wouldn't have even used. You know, that is a dirty secret to flavor, which is it involves lots of fat.
Exactly, and salt, too. It's always kind of shocking to be in, you know, a Michelin-starred kitchen and to see the amount of salt and butter that chefs are using. So to be able to control your own health and your own destiny, it's really imperative that you get into the kitchen and cook for yourself as much as possible.
So as part of that inspiration, going back to the beginning, and what I was mentioning about the value of starting as young as possible, which you can always sort of tell Julia regretted a bit, when you were at Epicurious, you created something, and hopefully I've gotten it right, the Healthy Lunchtime Challenge and Kid State Dinner, which was a recipe competition for kids from all 50 states that culminated in the winners attending a state dinner of sorts at the White House, hosted by none other than the former First Lady, Michelle Obama. So if you can describe for our listeners, what exactly is a kid state dinner, and what's it like to attend one?
Yeah, it was such an incredible, surreal, beautiful experience to have done this. We did it for 5 years. We had the first one in 2012, I believe, and 2011. And I was just so surprised that they allowed us to take what was an initial concept by me and take it like to 10 levels above anything I could have ever imagined. It was really an amazing experience, not just for myself, but for the parents and for the children who would win, because they were treated like the dignitaries that they are, the good food ambassadors, and they would be announced through the lobby in the way that the Prime Minister of India is announced, or whomever the visiting dignitaries for state dinners are announced. And we would all go up to the public first floor and have different activities. The band would play, the Army band, with so the beautiful music, and the decorations were spectacular, and they were always revolved around food, healthy food, like apple displays and just beautiful things that the White House decorators thought up.
And what was that reminds me to ask you what the menu was. The menu was made up of the kids' recipes, wasn't it, or is that wrong?
Yes, it was, yes. The menu was made up of six or seven of the winning dishes that complemented each other. So the smoothies and the appetizers and the entrees for the sides and the desserts, they were all the kids' winning recipes. So and we printed their names on the menus and gave them credit.
And then the food was, I assume, all prepared like any state dinner in the White House kitchen?
Yes, absolutely. The White House chefs prepared all of the meals, and it came out in livery service, as it does at every state dinner. Mrs. Obama spoke, and I spoke, and a child spoke at them. And the president came out, I think, at every single one and said a few words and shook kids' hands. And the kids also had an opportunity to take a picture with Mrs. Obama that they got to keep. So it was a really amazing day. And then it all ended by a visit to the kitchen gardens out on the South Lawn of the White House, which are amazing. They grow tons of things like kale and broccoli and Brussels sprouts and tomatoes, and they have a beehive. So it was just a really wonderful day. And kids went on to be so inspired by this event that they have done things like have hunger conferences, kid-led hunger conferences, have started health initiatives around kids' healthy eating. They've done YouTube channels. They've just gone on to do amazing things and to inspire not only their friends and family and community, but the world at large. So it's blossomed into a beautiful initiative.
So is the kitchen garden on the South Lawn, or it's also on the roof of the White House?
It's on the South Lawn. I don't think, actually, I know there was going to be a rooftop garden at some point, and there might have been in World War II, if memory serves correctly, but it's just on the South Lawn now.
I see. That's my faulty memory or reading the wrong thing. I'm glad to have it from a source who's been in it and knows for sure. So you were actually starting to talk about this. Do you think that the Kids State Dinner and particularly the Healthy Lunchtime Challenge, do you think it's had an impact on what seems to be a perilous state of kids' health and eating habits today, or how do you think it's been perceived?
I do think it's made an impact. I think Mrs. Obama's giving it a kind of a national prominence and an international prominence has really helped, especially with kids that are younger. So high school kids were kind of on the cusp of this movement, but younger kids are definitely very aware of the need and importance of eating healthfully. That doesn't mean that we all, you know, that they do or we all practice it as much as we would like, but there is definitely now an understanding of the importance that children have now of why they should be eating healthfully. And it's very important that we always, when we talk about this, that we always emphasize the notion of being strong and being your best self, rather than, you know, losing weight or diabetes or whatever it is. It's important to kind of emphasize the positive. And, you know, we should all be eating healthfully so that we can be our best selves.
Well, no, I mean, that's a great message in that, yeah, how it contributes to, again, leading an overall fulfilling life than necessarily conforming to any one image as long as you're healthy. So what's happening with the Healthy Lunchtime Challenge program now?
Well, since Mrs. Obama left, we have not picked it up with the new administration, but I have actually moved it something that is kind of a similar project to Canada, where we have started something called Kid Food Nation, which is a curriculum, a healthy eating curriculum, a lot of television and online spots about healthy eating with YTV, and also a gala as well, which we had in Ottawa, and Sophie Trudeau did the introductions via televised feed, which is great. So the Trudeaus are involved with this. And I'm now in discussions with the Scottish government to do something there. So I'm hoping to make this kind of a worldwide movement.
So it's also sort of a collection of progressive world leaders.
Exactly. And I feel like the more countries I can take this notion to, the better, you know, the more impact I can have, you know, kid by kid, who will then have their own impact in their own community. So it's, you know, it's throwing a stone into a lake, and the puddle, you know, the rings of the stone go out and out and out, and you keep affecting more and more people. So the more I can do, the happier I am.
Well, that's a great segue too to my next question. So as you're spreading the gospel through this, you know, both exciting and educational program, which I think is a great thing that also Julia represented, is how do you bring together the fun of food with the learning of food and make it enjoyable? And I think the more that it's enjoyable, the more that it sticks with you. So I know you're writing a new book for National Geographic Kids on the history of cooking. So tell us, when does that come out? And is it a cookbook or is it a different type of animal?
Yeah, I am so super excited about this good book. It's called Food Fight, A Mouthwatering History of Who Ate What and Why. And it literally traces how we ate, what we, how we got ingredients, you know, how we hunted, how we cooked, what tools we used, and then it gives some sample recipes from each era. And I've gone from the prehistoric era, ancient Egypt, ancient Rome, ancient Greece, all the way up through 14 of the most important historical moments in the world to 2050, where I kind of conjecture as to what we'll be eating on Mars. So it's been this extremely fun project, just so much fun to research, and I've tried to imbue it with humor and, you know, speak to the kid and make it exciting and interesting to them. I've talked about what a kid's day would be during that time, so the reader will really be able to place themselves in the, you know, Renaissance or during the Mongols or, you know, during the Industrial Revolution when kids were working in factories, that kind of thing, and get them excited not only about eating healthfully and cooking, but also getting excited about history, which is equally important to me, to get kids to understand why history is important and to kind of look back so they can look forward.
And when will the book be in stores?
It's going to be out September 11th, I believe, of this year on Amazon. So order it, pre-order it soon. We want to make it a big bestseller.
And does it have recipes in it too, or it's just a narrative with it, with different anecdotal stories?
It does. It has two recipes from each era. So they're inspired by the era, or they're actually authentic recipes that I've just adapted a little bit. So we've added some ingredients that are maybe not necessarily were used then but are used now just to keep it healthy. But, yeah, there's 30 recipes, and all of the recipes were tested by kids. So I know that these recipes work, that kids can do them, and I include some quotes from kids who have tested them.
Wow. Well, that's a pretty exciting repertoire of things to get kids into cooking and hopefully inspiring them not only lead healthier lives, but to be lifelong cooks, which I know would have made Julia very happy as her inspiration. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Tanya is going to take us behind the scenes of the Julia Child Award. And then lastly, reveal her own personal Julia moment. We'll be right back.
Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. One of the nice things about Bob's Red Mill is it's the only that I know of national supplier that's easily available for lots of interesting, hard-to-get grains and other seed products. So, you know, before Bob's Red Mill became widely available, you couldn't go get something like quinoa very easily, or you couldn't go get spelt easily in small quantities. But now you go to any one of the huge number of stores that carry Bob's Red Mill, and you can get smaller amounts of these really interesting, fun things to play with. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
We're back to take you behind the scenes of the Julia Child Award. While many people know Julia as a TV personality and cooking teacher, you may not know that Julia mentored a large number of people who went on to successful careers as chefs, cooking teachers, television personalities, and food writers. She also devoted a great deal of time to supporting many different aspects of the food industry as a whole, whether it's helping found the AIWF, which was the American Institute for Wine and Food, still is, or supporting the growth of the IACP, which is the International Association of Culinary Professionals, or even just singing the praises of California winemakers. So Julia's example really inspired the foundation to create the Julia Child Award in 2015 to help in its mission to further Julia's legacy. The foundation's trustees wanted to use the award to encourage people to cook for themselves and also to shine a spotlight on the best people in all parts of the food world who are following closely in Julia's footsteps. That means it goes to someone who is, in various ways, an educator, mentor, innovator, and trailblazer, as well as someone who also gives back to the community in a significant way. So basically, it's a very tall order. It's only for exceptional people, just as Julia was. So the first three recipients have been Chef Jacques Pepin, Chef Rick Bayless, and this year, restaurateur Danny Meyer of Union Square Hospitality Group, known most recently for his decision to eliminate tipping in his restaurant. And he's also one of the founders of the very popular burger joint, Shake Shack. And so the award comes with a grant of $50,000 that is made by the foundation, and then the recipient gets to choose a food-related nonprofit to receive the grant. The award is presented at a gala fundraising dinner for food history programming at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C., also the home of Julia's Kitchen. And that event, that gala, kicks off the museum's food history weekend. So back to talking to Tanya Steele, who is the award director for the Julia Child Award. Tanya, why do you think the jury selected Jacques, Rick, and Danny as the first recipients?
You know, they all exemplified all the incredible qualities that Julia exemplified. So everything from bridge builder and communicator to being a great educator and inspirational force for good. So Danny Meyer, for, as you just said, who won this year, or rather 2017, he had a profound influence on the way that restaurants are run, the way that restaurateurs treat diners, the way that wait staff are treated by their employers. He had a tremendous influence on a renaissance part of the neighborhood of Union Square in New York City, helping to kind of reinvigorate that neighborhood. He made burgers kind of upscale and but mass all at the same time with Shake Shack. So he keeps kind of raising the bar up and up and up in the hospitality industry. And so when we considered the, you know, the many exceptional people that could win the Julia Child Award, he seemed to kind of really just stand head and shoulders above everyone else because he really did hit every criteria that we had. Likewise, Rick Bayless really brought Mexican cuisine to America, providing us with a context and an appreciation for Mexico's sophisticated and, you know, delicious and healthy and yummy cuisine.
Yeah, I like how you were saying that the up and up and up. I think that's a great mnemonic for it because I was just thinking about when the maybe it was during the deliberation, but when the jury selected Rick, he was in the middle of like opening two or three restaurants at the same time, even though he still was running other wildly successful restaurants as the executive chef. And that's still a pretty, only someone with a certain kind of desire and commitment is going to push themselves to do that much more.
That's so true. And that's an important point about the Julia Child Award is it's not a lifetime achievement award. It's really celebrating someone who's at the pinnacle of their career and is someone who's continuing to build and increase the power and importance of what they're doing. So Rick absolutely is doing that. He's continuing to open up restaurants, continuing to do his PBS show, and he also has a fantastic foundation, Frontier Farmer Foundation, which helps Midwest farmers. So he's doing something incredibly important by helping to, support the efforts that farmers are doing in this country. Jacques Pepin is another instance. He may be older than the other two recipients, but he's still plugging away and doing what he does best, which is to really kind of get people in the same way that Julie did, really excited about sharing food, about cooking together, about families, about getting into the kitchen. And, of course, he shared a love of French food that Julia had. So he was also obvious.
No, I remember he was literally wrapping up another season of his television show. He launched a new dinnerware line at Sur La Table, which is really lovely because not only did he launch it, he designed it, literally the drawings. And many people may not realize that he's an artist in his own right and painter and makes beautiful watercolors and things like that. And again, just the list where you're like, when are these people sleeping?
That's right. It makes me feel like a lazy sloth when I, you know, go through what all of these potential nominees do every day. It's incredible. It does take a village, they are all these award winners are all doing spectacular things.
So take us into the jury deliberation room, and I know a lot of it is kind of secret, but in terms of what you can share with us, you know, how does the jury choose? Where do they find the up and up and up, and how do they make their selection?
Yes, well, we have, I think we've got it down to a really good, efficient, robust process. I create a short list of candidates that all of whom meet almost all of the criteria, if not all of it, and I circulate it to the jury 2 weeks beforehand for them to read all of the research that I've found on each of the candidates that is as most up-to-date as possible. We then meet for a few hours. Usually it's in Washington, D.C. or New York City, or it's also been in Los Angeles. And we deliberate. We lock ourselves in a room for, you know, 3 hours or 4 hours. We have some sustenance there, so some sandwiches and brownies to keep us going. And we go through each candidate and discuss them in depth and at length. And at the end of it, we go down the criteria for each and make sure that they're all hitting every bar. And then we vote, and sometimes it takes 3 or 4 rounds of voting to come up with what has always been a unanimous choice.
And so every year when you've done this, now you've done it 3 times and coming up on the 4th for 2018, has the end decision been the one that you kind of anticipated going into the room?
No. Sometimes I've thought, okay, this person's obviously going to win, and then it's been someone completely out of left field, like the person that I put on the list that I thought, I'm just putting this person on the list because it's an interesting choice. So I have been surprised. But, you know, people's arguments for or against someone are very impassioned and very eloquent and learned, so it's easy to understand, you know, how at the end of the day we get to the decision that we do once you've followed all of the different, you know, kind of back and forths. And it is a very passionate discussion. I mean, we're all very invested in the process. We often say to ourselves, what would Julia think? What would Julia do? Because, we're very much, all of the jury pool knew her, and so we feel like we're able to kind of channel her vision as well as ours while we're selecting.
And how do you think, I think that's a good way to move from the jury room to the public, and once it gets announced and with the program of the presentation with the National Museum of American History, how do you think the award's been received? It's still relatively new. It's only going into its 4th year with both within the food industry and by the public.
You know, considering it's a relatively new award, I feel like the Julia Child Award has been received extremely well. It's gotten so much publicity, both within the industry and in the kind of the general food world at large. It's gotten very quickly become renowned and known by many people. So I'm now getting pitched all the time by PR people saying, you know, you should consider my client who has made a significant impact in the way that Americans cook and eat today and drink. I'm out at conferences, meet talking to other food writers, they often will bring it up and say how incredible it is and what an amazing thing it is that the winner gets that $50,000 grant to further their efforts to help the world, because that really does make this award unusual and significant, because very few awards actually come with money attached that the winner can then use to the greater good. So that's something that makes it particularly special. And then even in the general food population, just general people I talk to, they always say, oh, my gosh, I love Julia Child. And then they often will mention that they saw somewhere, you know, on television or read about it online or in a newspaper that, you know, about the person who just won the award. So I think that the award's renown is really growing. So that's very satisfying.
Yeah, that is great to hear about, especially that people are absorbing part of that up and up and up message of both celebrating what the person of significance is achieving and giving back, as well as the component of the grant being able to help them achieve more, basically.
Exactly.
So what do you think, what do you see into your personal crystal ball about where the award's going in the years to come?
You know, I think it'll only continue to grow in importance and renown, and I hope it'll inspire others to think about ways that they can help further, you know, the causes that Julia believed in, which are, you know, to celebrate and appreciate the pleasures of the table. And I think that it'll also, hopefully the winners will inspire others to be their best selves in the way that we were just talking about getting kids to be their best selves. So I think all of those things will happen, and I'd like to think that in terms of food awards in general, this will, you know, become one of the most important in the industry.
And so after 3 years of you helping support the award and the foundation to make it happen, is it becoming old hat, or do you still find it exciting?
Oh, no, I completely find it exciting. I really do feel jazzed every time I think about you know, who could potentially win for this coming year, and I track people's careers to see who's doing things that are notable. So I feel like it never gets old. It gets just more exciting.
Well, that is also very great to hear, because we definitely enjoy working on it, and could not do it without you.
It's just been such a treat, and for me personally to have started, you know, with Julia as such an inspiration for me as a kid, it's so nice to kind of go full circle and be able to work on something that is very much, you know, for her and embodied by her.
Well, again, another perfect setup for what we're going to do next. So when we come back, Tanya is going to reveal her Julia moment. We'll be right back.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
In our last segment, which we like to call the Julia moment, we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she has inspired them in their career. And Tanya's kind of already talked about that, but I'm going to give her the formal opportunity to decide which of maybe her many choices is her Julia moment. So Tanya, over to you.
You know, I've been so lucky to have met her several times, and I have a lot of memories of her speaking, which are just—it's so distinctive. And you know, Todd, when you and I get into a meeting with some others, we start to, you know, imitate her. It's just so infectious, her voice and her just the way she spoke.
Yes, it's very hard not to. Some people find it impossible not to.
But I think that out of the many times that I got to meet her, my favorite Julia moment was the first time I met her, because I was an editor at Food & Wine at the time. So I'm going to say this was the late 80s or early 90s. And I was
when you were
in
a child editor,
office
right?
Cubicle and probably fact-checking an article by Robert Parker, if memory serves. And I heard her voice, you know, kind of three cubicles down. And I thought, oh, my God, no way. You know, I couldn't believe it. In the flesh, I could hear my hero. And I could hear her talking and, you know, with her high-pitched voice and laughing. And so I just froze, you know, oh, my gosh, this, she's really here. You know, I didn't know she was coming. So I kind of peeked out, and I could see her, and it was so exciting. So I stood at the door of my cubicle and waited till she walked over. And as she walked over, she came, and she was still very tall at that time. She was probably in her 80s or something. And she was taller than I. She was probably 6 foot or 6 foot one. It's still at that point. And she came over and so sweetly shook my hand and, you know, treated me like, you know, a long-lost daughter and, you know, how lovely it was to meet me and everything, and made me feel so comfortable and relaxed, even though I was, you know, it was like meeting, you know, John Lennon. It was like you couldn't meet, like, a cooler person. It was just so exciting, and she just made me feel just calm and relaxed and just joyful. I mean, it was just joyful to meet her. But I remember being surprised by kind of how tall and sweet.
Which the listeners knew you are not short either. So the fact that you would...
I'm not short, and I'm used to, you know, my children are now 6'5", and so I'm used to tall people. But she was still, in, you know, in, as an older person, still quite tall. So I was surprised, but yet she seemed, there was such a softness about her.
She was that incredible combination of having a tremendous amount of presence and a tremendous amount of warmth all at the same time. And she just sort of enveloped you with her aura and her energy, which is why I think, you know, so many people have, who maybe met her even in a much less professional setting or even just at a book signing, felt that, you know, well, she would definitely remember them because of how intimate that moment was. And it was just, I think, a special gift that she had that was innate.
That's so true. It's kind of the graciousness that I feel like doesn't exist very much anymore. And, you know, they always say, and it's true, having met both President Obama and President Clinton, the way that they look at you and shake your hand, you feel like it's just the two of you in that room,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
alone. And that was the way that Julia was. So when she shook your hand and she looked into your eyes and she said something, you felt like, you know, it was the two of you communing, you know, and that she was really present at that moment and wanting to kind of...
And I think that's definitely true. She really was present, just as I imagine those two presidents are. I think certain people have that unique ability. But one of the things is not just graciousness or being polite. It's genuine. And it comes from this genuine interest in other people. But it still is quite powerful.
Exactly. And just, again, one more full circle. I think that's really important and something that I transmit to the kids that I work with. And so, for instance, all the winners of the Kids Date Dinner, they would come to the Smithsonian to see Julia's kitchen and right before we went to the White House. And I would explain to them why Julia was important to me personally. And then I would explain to them that I had shook Julia's hand several times, and so I wanted to shake their hand because I was transmitting Julia's touch to them. So it was like this generational kind of handoff, and I expected them to do the same to their friends. So I think that notion of kind of meeting someone and shaking their hand and looking into their eyes and knowing that you're having like a true connection is an important thing that we want to continue foster with our kids.
Well, no, thank you, Tanya. That is an absolutely really great way to kind of summarize a Julia moment outside of, you know, a food or a dish, but that it, not just the power and presence that she had that was so special that you experienced, but the idea of taking that experience and passing it along to other people, that is terrific. So thank you very much. I think you snuck in more than one Julia moment, but we'll let you get away with that as one of our first guests.
Well, thanks so much, Todd. Thanks for having me.
My sincere pleasure. Thank you. And thank you to all our listeners. Thanks for listening. Let us know what you think about today's show. You can reach us via email or even send us a voice memo to contact@joyachildfoundation.org. Please like us on Facebook. Just search at Julia Child. You can follow the foundation on Twitter at Julia Child JCF. And I'm at T Shulkin, T-S-C-H-U-L-K-I-N. That's my Twitter handle. You can learn more about the Julia Child Award itself on juliachildaward.com or search at Julia Child Award on Facebook and Twitter to follow. We look forward to bringing you back into the foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.